quite a while now, the conventional wisdom has been that print is dead. But although Gourmet magazine folded this past year and Newsweek's business was valued at $1, there does seem to be at least one sector of print that's not only surviving but growing, the literary magazine. To update us about what's happening in that world, I'm pleased to welcome to our show Ann Kelberg, editor of the new journal called Little Star, Keith Gessen, an editor of N Plus One magazine, and Hannah Tinty, editor of One Story. It's a pleasure to welcome you to our show. And your magazine, Little Star, is just 1 year old and the newest of this group. What made you decide to start it at a time when, as I said, print is supposedly dying?
Well, I feel like my experience of starting Little Star was actually one of an opening of possibilities rather than an ending of possibilities. When I was growing up in publishing in the 80s, you really had to get together an enormous cast of characters in order to start anything. And it's just in the last few years that technology has made it possible for, you know, a small group or even one person with a kind of a mission and a dream to pull together something and make it happen.
Although it still costs money. Did anybody try to talk you out of it?
Well, I didn't give them the chance.
What about you, Keith? Was that a concern for you?
Money. It's been a constant concern. But we, you know, there were four of us. We each threw in $2,000 to make $8,000. And that was enough to print the first issue.
And you, Mickey Rooney, and Judy Garland, and who was the fourth? It sounds like that.
It was a bit like that. It was a bit like that. Benjamin Kunkel, Marco Roth, Mark Greif. And, you know, we managed to print the first issue. One of the things that sometimes gets left out of these conversations, it's still pretty cheap to print stuff. So until it's becoming more and more expensive to mail stuff. But printing is still surprisingly cheap.
Well, the conventional wisdom now is that you just put it on the net and then you do an e-zine, no?
I do think there is something about having a printed matter. For One Story, we mail – One Story is a literary magazine that publishes one short story at a time. One story gets mailed to our subscribers every 3 weeks. We're also available, you know, via the Kindle, but there is something I think very nice about getting something in printed in the mail where now all you do is get his bills for the most part.
Well, Hannah, were you worried at all about limiting yourself in that way? One story every 3 weeks? And why not one story every 4 weeks?
Well, I think there was something we were trying to hit, which was to come out frequently as a magazine creates a relationship with your subscribers. When you miss your New Yorker, for example, you know you've missed your New Yorker for the week. So we were trying to come out as frequently as possible.
Although if you don't like the short story in a particular issue of the New Yorker, there are always those big essays and the cartoons to keep you interested.
It puts a lot of pressure on the short story that we do publish. So we work very hard to make each story very strong and stand on its own. But there is something really magical, I think, at looking at short stories as individual works of art, which is what we were going for.
Were you all editors before you started these magazines?
I was an editor. I worked at the New York Review of Books for many years. Mm-hmm. And before that at Ferrer Strauss, where there was a strong commitment to literary publishing and relationships between authors and editors.
And you also wrote?
No, I'm just an editor.
I was a freelance writer who was always getting into arguments with his editors.
So you decided that it would be best to edit for yourself.
Exactly.
Because this is like the old idea that the best cook is you because you know what you like.
Well, but it turned out that we had to edit each other, and we were actually much harsher editors, and it caused a lot of it strained our friendships.
But you're okay now?
We're okay now.
And what about you, Hannah?
My background was originally starting in magazines. I'd worked at the Atlantic Monthly with Michael Curtis, which was a fantastic experience learning from him. I think he's one of the great editors around these days, and also worked at the Boston Review. But I'm also a writer. I've published two books. So it's sort of what I enjoy about editing is allows me to, first of all, be a little social, where a writer's life is very solitary. And the relationships I form with the writers are, you know, very dear to me.
Well, there used to be a time when there were a lot of commercial magazines publishing fiction. You obviously all feel like you're filling a void. And to some degree, aren't you helped by the fact that there are fewer? Because you can get some pretty good writers to give you work that in the past you might not have been able to gain access to.
there are a lot of short stories looking for homes. We get a huge amount of submitters each year. But there are also a great amount of readers and people very eager to read short fiction. We found we have about 10,000 subscribers, which for a literary magazine is quite large.
I think we're also really living in shifting times where the big old institutions that used to provide people with a literary experience are under a lot of pressure. The traditional magazines and traditional publishing houses, and there are now so many new ways of getting a reading experience technologically, but a lot of them tend to favor an experience that's fast. I think this is what literary editors are kind of looking at, that how can we in digital times recreate a reading experience that gives people time for to be moved or exalted or changed by literature instead of rushing on to the next thing? So I think we're all in our different ways trying to do that in the digital world. And I think it's fascinating that like N+1 particularly comes to my mind as something that's very modern and of the moment, but also really harks back to these old traditions in America, like Partisan Review and these magazines that were both very political and intellectual at the same time. I just think it's so interesting that at this time, these old forms are having this new life.
Well, most of them are gone. We have a few new ones like McSweeney's also. But the two magazines that seem to publish fiction on a regular basis are The New Yorker and Harper's, and I guess they're kind of old style, aren't they, in their approach? Although there are differences. Since Sean stopped being the editor of The New Yorker, they've started including a lot of four-letter words. That's a big difference, isn't it?
I think so, and I believe that also the difference that smaller literary magazines like the three of us can provide is a space to particularly showcase new voices, which at this point, because the market is so small for, you know, for literary fiction, in particular for The New Yorker or Harper's, there aren't that many places. But it's up to us to really usher in the next generation of great writers.
And those old magazines usually get submissions from agents, don't they?
Yes, we do too.
Uh-huh. Mostly, or do you have rules? Do you have a slush pile? Do you have
Oh, yes, we have a slush pile.
I publish from the slush pile. That's one of the joys of it for me.
You publish some pretty prominent authors. So are they sending stuff into the slush pile as well these days?
Well, some of them I begged, but others of them came in out of the blue. And I think that what they were looking for I think writers sometimes feel in the general interest magazines that they are competing with a lot of other kinds of thinking and that they're looking for a place to be published that can be more reflective or more kind of aesthetically oriented. I've also found that I've lost my train of thought. I have a slightly different emphasis from Hannah's in that part of what I think I'd like to do is to have an environment where mature writers are side by side with youthful writers. I feel like there's actually a lot of emphasis in our literary culture on discovering the new, and we don't really in our publishing world kind of embrace the whole culture and the whole civilization. So, you know, I love to have a brand new guy who's a bartender in Boston next to Seamus Heaney and to be able to say that they all breathe the same air.
I think one thing that we do is because we're just one story, we're not putting them side by side, but we have sort of a family, I would say, so we'll publish a very established author. For example, we recently published a short story by great writer A.M. Holmes, and then the next writer is someone who's, you know, has not published a book yet. So we'll sort of go back and forth between established authors and new writers.
In your case, I'm assuming that you have certain word counts because you want to keep it limited. You don't want them to be too small and you don't want them to be too big.
Exactly. We usually go somewhere between 3,000 and 8,000 words, although occasionally we'll do a special double issue. For our 100th issue, we published a great story by Ron Carlson called Beanball, and that one was, I think, about 17,000 words.
N+1 is the only one of these magazines that has illustrations. They add to the cost, don't they?
Not if they're black and white. Nope. which sometimes they in the last issue we had a few pieces that didn't reproduce as well in black and white. But you asked earlier about rules. We have a rule of one famous person per issue. So we try to keep – we have a quota You can't have too many famous writers.
But they do sell magazines.
That's true. Not that selling a lot of magazines – we're never going to sell a whole lot of Endless One, I'm afraid. The other rule we have is we don't write about dead authors. We feel like we do a fair amount of literary criticism. We feel like there are a lot of very good venues for writing about Flaubert and Pushkin. And our emphasis is on living contemporary authors.
But you said you're not going to – you don't expect to sell a lot of magazines. People do – people in the field are aware of all of your publications. So who do you think is paying most attention to you, the people in the business or you have to reach readers, don't you? How do you do that?
Well, we actually these days get a lot of information about our readers. You know, we can tell exactly who's clicking on our websites and stuff. And it's very gratifying to see people from all over the country reading and being interested and excited about your work. So that's almost as gratifying as having a whole bunch of people you really respect in New York being excited about it.
We, you know, we initially we were very concerned that all our subscribers were going to be in Manhattan and Brooklyn. But over the years as –
is there anything wrong with Manhattan and Brooklyn?
Perfectly nice boroughs among the five boroughs.
I've lived in both places.
Very nice places. But we've actually have noticed that when we look at where our subscribers are from, there are more and more from the Midwest and from California.
Well, I think that if you were to check out the New Yorker subscriber list, you'd find out that there are a lot more non-New Yorkers reading the New Yorker than New Yorkers.
I think that's true. There's always going to be a sort of heavy weight on both coasts, so West Coast and the East Coast. For one story, where we actually have subscribers in all 50 states. So it's sort
And how did you get them to know that you even exist?
You know, what happened was I think because our format was so different than what a lot of magazines were doing. And again, we started it in 2002, so we've been around for a while. And each time someone would find out about us, there would be another article or something written about us. And each article where it appeared, for example, there was a piece on us in Oprah's magazine. And when that happened, suddenly we had this huge pop in the Midwest. So different things like that can open up different venues. But I think it's also been a word of mouth thing. We have our subscribers are very loyal and excited about the magazine. I think it's a good sign for short fiction.
We have the editors of three literary magazines with us, Hannah Tinty, editor of One Story, Keith Gessen, editor of one of the quartet of editors of N Plus One, and Anne Kelberg, editor of Little Star. And we'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We have three editors of literary magazines here today comparing notes, Anne Kelberg of Little Star, Keith Gessen of N Plus One, and Hannah Tinty of One Story. Keith and Anne, you both publish nonfiction as well as fiction. How do you balance it?
For me, I've spent a lot of my life editing nonfiction, and so that's not really what I wanted to do with Little Star. In Little Star, I mostly publish nonfiction that's very lyrical, or where the language is really the main interest.
And Keith, we know that you'll never publish an article about Flaubert, Proust, or who else did you say?
None of those dead guys. Pushkin.
Pushkin.
Forget it.
Oh, gee, I was looking forward to an article on Pushkin. So what is your nonfiction like?
We tend to publish stories that are more essayistic and essays that are more fictional. So one of our favorite writers is Elif Batuman, who writes these accounts of her academic life and her life of traveling to Russia in a way that really resembles fiction. There are very funny dialogues. There's a lot of sort of interior monologue. So it's highly entertaining, but also it has a real intellectual content.
Do you pay your contributors, Hannah?
Yes, we do.
A lot of the small publications are not doing that. For example, Brooklyn Rail has made its pages available to writers who will probably not get published elsewhere, even though they have really interesting things to say. Do you all pay your contributors?
Not as much as I would like.
It's never as much as
a dream.
I would like.
We pay a pittance. But we're working on it. We're working on it.
You don't accept advertising, do you?
Sure.
Oh, you do?
Bring it on.
Yeah, maybe the low-paid show could buy.
Yeah.
We were hoping that you would buy some airtime on our show, actually, because you'd be reaching your target audience here. But how do you pay for everything? I mean, it still is expensive. Do you rely on grants and contributions? I know every so often I will get a letter from some small publication saying, please, we need your help. You can send in $300, $500.
Absolutely. I'm not sure whether or not, I mean, One Story is a nonprofit. I'm not sure whether or not you guys both are as well. But so we are absolutely always looking for supporters, and we do get grants. We recently got a great grant from the NEA to help us support emerging authors and to do special promotions for them. So every time we do publish an author who's at the start of their career, we do some additional promotions and advertising for them to get their name out there and help them get to be known. But also, One Story is our business model was built around, you know, Keith mentioned earlier how expensive it is to mail things. Because we're only One Story, it keeps our mailing costs down. And because we're sort of printing just sort of a simple 5x7 format, it also our printing costs are down. So everything around our business model was to keep our prices as low as possible.
Can any of you get onto newsstands?
We're on newsstands. Mm-hmm.
But then you got to get somebody who's a distributor to do that for you.
Yes, and that's been, like everything else, some of the smaller distributors have closed down in the past few years, so that's becoming more and more difficult, but it's still possible.
Because of our model, we've only done subscription only, and it's a little bit over a dollar an issue. It's $21 for a year subscription.
Oh. And you publish something that's like 8x10, but you publish it in a horizontal format. It kind of looks like two book pages side by side.
Oh, I misled you with an early draft that I sent you. It does look more like an ordinary book. I feel like I would love to sort out the distribution. It seems to me that in the past there have been more creative approaches to distribution, but it's such a difficult problem that a lot of those places have folded, and now distribution is very monolithic and hard to break into. But I think in New York we're really benefiting from another renaissance in independent bookstores. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems to me that just 10 years ago we were all lamenting that the chains were going to destroy independence in New York, and now there are all these great places.
And the chains are going under.
And the chains are going under.
I remember when McNally opened a few years ago on Prince, and I thought, oh, geez, that's so close to St. Mark's, right? How is that going to work? But, of course, there's a gajillion people in New York. Uh-huh. And if you can have a Duane Reade every 50 feet, you can probably have a bookstore every 10 blocks. So
and what these places are great at doing is, you know, they're not just committed to selling books, but committed to an idea of literary culture. You know, they have readings, they have parties, and they're so enthusiastic about the new things that come out.
Do you have a sense of the demographics of your readers? Because if you're selling them at bookstores, you don't. But if you're selling them by subscription, especially if you can stick a little questionnaire in there every once in a while, you can get a pretty good idea of who's reading your publication.
Well, we're pretty much, I think it's 60% women, 40% men. You know,
Has that always been the case, that women tend to read?
Women do tend to read more and tend to buy more books, I think, across the board.
Why do you think that is, Keith?
There's something wrong with us.
One is sort of manly.
Well, I remember being told more than once that, you know, that men are are later to mature if they ever mature. So that may be part of the problem.
There's been a lot of good sports on TV recently.
So. But do you find that your readers tend to split down? I'm sure you also try to balance out the people you publish, male, female.
We have no idea. We know the geographic distribution. We don't know the gender or age distribution.
I feel like a lot of my readers are writers. I see their names on the list, and then I discover that they have a blog, or I see their story somewhere. That's probably a kind of American phenomenon, that a lot of our readers are themselves writers.
Are you able to pay yourselves? You made a face.
Not.
No.
Again, a pittance. I think it's, you know, I'm sure all of us are here and are doing it out of the love. There's a reason why we're doing this. For me, I love being engaged in meeting new writers and being a part of this process. There's nothing more exciting for me than working with a writer on their story.
In the old days, pretty much every Hollywood movie was based on a Saturday Evening Post story. Have you been approached by movies, or have there been any book deals that have come out of any of the things you've published?
There's been a lot of our writers, if they don't have an agent before they publish with us, end up getting a lot of agent interest. Several of our authors have then gone on to publish books who've been published. Last year, for our first benefit, we hosted something called the Literary Debutante Ball, which we featured authors who had published their very first fiction with us, who then gone on and to greater recognition. And we're going to be doing that again this year. So it's sort of a fun sort of spoof where they are escorted by an established author who has been a mentor for them.
Well, stranger things have happened than Elif Batuman's travels to Uzbekistan being turned into a major Hollywood film, or our critique of The Hipster. So it could happen. Certainly some books have come out of N+1 essays. Elif Batuman, Philip Connors published with us. He has a book coming out next year. Melanie Toumani published a piece on Armenia and Turkey and the genocide, which she's turning into a book. So it's one of the advantages of these magazines that you do have enough space. And you aren't being asked to necessarily write about something that happened this week or this month. And you can let your mind wander a bit. And that sort of thing can turn into a book much more easily than something that you wrote that was very current.
Has the mission of N+1 changed since it started?
I think it has. When we started, the Iraq War was something that was very much on our minds. The liberal hawks were something that we talked about a lot. Since then, we've thought a lot more about the internet. We've thought a lot more about...
It's impossible to not think about the internet.
It is impossible not to think about the internet, especially in New York, strangely enough.
Why especially in New York?
I think in New York...
I thought it was just BlackBerries in New York.
In New York, there's a lot of people who are affected by the economic shifts of the internet. So there's a lot of people in publishing, there's a lot of magazines. The New York Times is in New York, their bottom line is really affected by what's going on the internet.
Now, Anne, your magazine is too young for you to have developed any big theories.
Oh, no. I'm sure I had some big theories to start with.
Yeah, it's the best time at the beginning.
I know, really, before they're shot down by the experience. But one of the things I'm reminded of by what you said about N+1 is, I kind of wrote about this in my little blurb when I started Little Star, that, back in the day, people would come, like Lizzie Hardwick coming to New York from Kentucky. They would come to New York with the idea that they were seeking out kind of a literary society and that they would find people here who were like-minded. And I think a lot of that sense that there is such a thing as literary society is created by magazines, that it's an editorial idea that creates a sense of common conversation. So the New Yorker had such an influence in America on the way people thought about how people speak to each other or how people deal with each other. And N+1 has really, for me, created a new kind of literary society, or brought it into my line of vision. So I'm sort of curious to ask you, if I may.
Please.
What you think about that? When the four of you got together, did you feel like there was a kind of a world that hadn't found its voice, or did the creation of your magazine create that world?
A little bit. I think, we felt like the best minds of our generation were writing book reviews. And we felt we had more inside ourselves than just book reviews. But what you say is very – we get these emails sometimes from people. They say, oh, I really want to come hang out in the N+1 office. And as if there was something very exciting going on. And there's – I have to tell you, there's not. It's mostly repackaging subscriptions.
So what do they do? Go back to their Facebook pages?
Well, no. But I think the point is, as Anne says, that – it creates the idea of a community. It creates the idea of a literary community and the idea of people who take this stuff very seriously and are willing to devote their lives to it and be paid a pittance.
What about that other, the new idea of what community is all about, Facebook and and tweeting and all of that.
That's been really important for me. My magazine is small and new, and it's been a way that I can find like-minded people all over the country. Even though before I did Little Star, my tweeting profile was very minimal. I love doing it, but my Twitter and Facebook life is all about stuff in the world. I never talk about what I'm doing. I hardly ever use the first person.
It's about you're using
what's
Facebook,
going on.
Using Facebook to some degree to promote your magazine.
Well, no. It kind of comes back to this idea of a magazine as a community or an expression of place.
No, the reason I asked is because of what Keith said. In the old days in New York, there were hangouts. People would go to coffee shops or bars, and whether you were an artist or you were a writer, you pretty much knew that one day or another you're going to meet everybody you knew, and then you went to the same parties. And you don't have that sense anymore, and it's my sense now that people are doing so much more of that simply through the internet.
I think you do. Yeah, there is a kind of community, but it's a little different. For one story, we do actual physical events, which we do pretty regularly whenever one of our writers is in town. But by having, for example, when each story comes out, for one story, we do a Q&A with the author about the story behind the story, how they wrote it, what was their inspiration. We put all that information on our website, and our subscribers, after they read the story, then go there and they share their comments. So it's a way of actually creating a kind of community that, you know, people who don't live in New York can take part in. And that's part of our philosophy, is to try and create a larger community of just short story lovers.
In the old days, you had to come to New York to be part of the whole thing. Now you can be a part of it everywhere.
It should be said, though, that ultimately the point of a literary community is so that people can meet each other and fall in love and, you know, sleep together. So you can't do that on Facebook. So ultimately, you do have to meet up. Facebook is a good way of arranging that. Mm. But in the end, you have to be there.
But beware of Craigslist.
Subscribing to N Plus One is a good place.
It's a very good start.
So where do people buy your magazines? They just go – they just Google in the name and follow the instructions?
For us, it's all online. Our website's oneone-story.com and – everything could be done from there. It's a great Christmas gift. You should, for the holidays, subscribe to a literary magazine, one of us. Or all three.
Well, if someone asked your advice, would you encourage them to start a literary magazine? Anne?
I don't want the competition.
Mm-hmm. That is the most honest answer. Everybody's like, yeah, great. You should all do it. No,
I'd encourage them to read mine.
I would say yes if they – the most important thing is to have a strong point of view for your magazine. Mm-hmm. And the what oftentimes I see, you know, as you're around for a while, we've been around for almost 10 years, you see a lot of literary magazines come and go and come and go with people's resources or energy flags after a year or two. So to have staying power, you really need to have a strong idea behind the magazine.
We've run out of time, but I want to thank all of you so much for being with us. Hannah Tinti is editor of One Story, Anne Kelberg, editor of Little Star, and Keith Gessen, one of the editors of N Plus One magazine. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
And I think maybe I'll start a literary magazine.
Oh, do. Yeah. I'll encourage you.